Is it under here? Okay.
I will now call this meeting of the Planning and Zoning Commission to order. Secretary Carroll, may we have the roll?
Commissioner Lowe?
Here.
Commissioner Stanton?
Here.
Commissioner Burns? Commissioner McMahon?
Present.
I'm here. Commissioner Gawey Jones?
Here.
Commissioner Placer?
Here.
Commissioner Kimball?
Here.
Commissioner Wilson?
Here.
Oh, wow.
Thank you, Mr. Zinner. Are there any adjustments to our agenda?
No, there are not, ma'am.
Move to approve.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner McMahon, seconded by Commissioner Stanton. Can I get a thumbs up approval, please? It is unanimously approved. You should have received a copy of our last meeting's minutes. Are there any adjustments or changes to said minutes?
Move to approve.
Second.
Approval moved by Commissioner McMahon and seconded by Commissioner Stanton. Thumbs up approval on the minutes. We didn't have any absences last time, did we? Unanimous approval. Oh, we did. It's fine. Okay. Moving on, public hearings. The only topic on our agenda is case number 262-2022, a request by the City of Columbia to amend Chapter 29, Sections 29.2.1, Establishment and Conversion of Districts, 29.2.2, Bay Zoning Districts, 29.3.1, General, 29.3.3, Use Specific Standards, 29.3.4, C2 District outside of the MDT regulating plan boundary, 29.4.3, Parking and Loading, 29.5.1, Subdivision Standards, 29.5.2, Subdivision and Land Procedures. This is a public hearing, but before we take comment, could we have a staff report?
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chairman. As you said, this is our case for the evening, and it is a considered to be a zoning text amendment. So zoning is in the Unified Development Code, so it's an amendment to the UDC. So we do kind of a package of them. They are listed as four separate amendments. Some of them are fairly small, some are a little more significant, so we'll jump right into those. But it is a public hearing notice required case when we're amending the text of the zoning. And so it was published in the Tribune on September 7th. So just kind of a quick overview of our phasing here for our text amendment. So we have been doing this over the last year or two, bringing forth several text amendments that have been identified for several specific reasons that have been laid out. One of those, if there's just general errors in the code, if there's confusing language in the code, and we have a couple tonight that are of the variety where there's been some relief sought by applicants in the recent past and some type of relief was granted. So that is another reason we'd bring something up to say, hey, something is may need to be looked at on this line of code because we're having some requests for variances or relief through PD zoning. And it has been granted, so let's take a look at that and see if we need to do something with it. So two of those are of that nature this evening. And that's the first one we'll start off with, actually. So A1 through A4, the text amendments, basically everything that's highlighted is changed. If it's struck through, it's deleted. If it's underlined, it's been added. And just a little formatting. Instead of kind of, you know, line item in a lot of things, if there's a little bit of change in a sentence, it may just be entirely deleted and then restated below. So even though it looks like we're deleting a lot, most of the code that we're deleting is just restated differently, and so we've just inserted an entire new line. In the staff report and in the very front of the report is kind of just a Cliff Notes version of the changes. And so anyone who didn't necessarily want to read all the way through the report could get an idea generally of what's being proposed. Amendment one is to a couple different sections. So we're going to be in 29.3, which is our permitted uses, and then 29.4, which is form and development code. So that's where our parking is. And so we have a provision in the code for stacking and drive-through uses. And there's two sections in those different areas of the code that kind of work together. And so we're revising both of those for a few different reasons. And just so we kind of have an idea of what we're talking about, so we're talking about drive-throughs. We'll be talking about stacking lanes. So stacking lane, if you see on this, basically on the top is the service window. Stacking lanes are the ones, basically the parking spaces in a lane for cars that are stacking waiting on the service window. We have bypass lane requirements too, and that's going along the outside. So just kind of a little bit of visual there for what we'll be discussing a little bit. With that, we'll kind of jump into what we're changing. We're going to start in use-specific standards. So this is in related to drive-up facilities. So drive-up facilities is considered to be an accessory use, which means it has to be partnered with a main use, a principal use. In some districts, it's also conditional. So if you wanted to have a drive-through facility attached to, say, a restaurant, then in the MN district, you would need to come in and ask for conditional use approval through this body. If you're in the MC district, it's permitted as of right. So that's a little bit of the distinction there. The code in 29.3.2 is a permitted use table, and in that will tell you where all the uses are listed. 3.3 is use-specific standards. And use-specific standards lists some additional criteria that the permitted uses are subject to. So that's where we're going to be starting. So in the use-specific standards for drive-through facility, first thing we've done, it shows in here that we've deleted the first two lines. So there's two lines, two sections under the use-specific standards for drive-through. Both of those are deleted. Very little of that text is actually removed, though. Most of that has been restated and itemized a little more. If you look at number one, there's a lot in there packaged together, so we've spread it out a little bit more to make it easier to read through. But almost all of this really is restated again in list form in this section. So one thing we've done is right now there's a one and a two. So just to kind of put these into bundles, use-specific standards will now have three sections. And each of those sections has a specific purpose, and the first one is to state the purpose. And so for the drive-through facility, based on conversations we had during work sessions, and just to kind of recap, we had a number of work sessions on these text amendments this summer. One of those was the idea of having a purpose statement, because there was some confusion about why do we regulate the location of drive-through service windows. So the purpose here of the entire section for drive-through facilities is basically to help reduce visual impacts of drive-throughs and all the ill effects sometimes of drive facilities that come with it, like idling cars, and if you're close to residential, the additional noise and the pollution. So we've added that purpose statement, and that will help kind of guide individuals and also other city boards if they're reviewing variances or relief from the section to understand why it's there in the first place. So that's section number one. Section two and three have some additional sections, but I wanted to show them here just for clarification. Two is general requirements. There'll be eight general requirements, and that's going to apply to all drive-up facilities. And number three is conditional uses, and there's a number of additional stipulations under that. So we'll kind of get into two and three after this. So I just kind of want to group those so we see where everything's kind of starting out. So general requirements. In general, this will apply to all drive-up facilities, no matter what zoning district you are in. The first five is those sections we've deleted, just restated and more spread out so you can kind of read it a little easier. So basically, the same restrictions are going to apply. Basically, screening is going to be required if you're within 100 feet of an R1 or R2 zone. No speakers facing those zones, no menu boards visible. And so on and so forth. So there's five there that are existing now, and we're not proposing really any changes to those, so I won't spend a lot of time on those first five. Number six is really where we start to add some additional new restrictions. Six specifically is one that really was born out of our work session conversations about some concerns that the commission had with current drive-up facility design, and that was really the issue with drive-through stacking sometimes interfering with the circulation on site. And so six is meant to help give the city a little bit more regulation in terms of where you can place that stacking so that it It isn't going to go directly behind parking spaces. It's not going to go directly across a drive aisle. And that is intended then again to help the internal circulation on a site. Number seven, and this is kind of really the principal reason that this was brought forward. There was a couple of cases that came through with PDs in front of this body, PD zoning and PD plans. Two of them were approved with service windows facing a street. And so just to clarify right now, the code does say a service window. Let's see if I have that here. Okay, just so we all know what we're talking about. A service window in this situation is where you're picking up your food in this example. So a service window can't face a public street. That's the current standard. So it has to be facing away from the public street. In both those situations, there was findings that in those situations, a service window could face a street under certain circumstances. One of those was the Culver's example. In that case, they had proposed to basically screen the service window from view with essentially a wall connected to the building that was integrated into the building both physically and stylistically. So it was looked like the building, right? It blended in with it. That was a little over 30 feet wide. And so we kind of used that a little bit as an example. Our discussion was based on kind of that example, and from that, the decision was to go ahead and allow some additional exceptions so that a drive-through service window could face the street. And in that situation, we came up with really two situations where that would be allowed. And number one is A under that section. So A basically says you need two elements. You need, as we now know, what the structure was built at Culver's is a porte cochere, or however you choose to pronounce that.
All right.
It's essentially the wall. It's a wall, and I have a picture of it here. So this is on the far right. You see basically a screening wall integrated in the building. It's attractive. It looks like the building. So, and it's going to screen, you know, to a certain degree, the service window and the car picking up the products and the goods at that point. So that would be required if you wanted to place your service window facing a public street. It's going to be a minimum of 20 feet wide. And 20 feet was settled because there was some concerns with cars being blocked in case of emergency. So 20 is really the space for one parking space. So it really should only affect the car that's in the service window at that moment. So everything behind it should, in theory, be able to go around in case of emergencies and use the bypass lane. We put in some additional language, actually, since the work session. I did want to point out we felt it important if it did come up where we had two service windows to point out that you do need to do both. On a window. So in the McDonald's example, which you just saw, it does have two service windows. It would need two separate ones. There's nothing restricting them from making it longer, I suppose, but the minimum still is 20 feet per structure. And some language in there to kind of really, to make sure it is integrated in the building. So we don't just want a blank wall there. It does need to, architecturally integrate into the building. So that's one part. The second part is then the landscaping component that would screen the stacking area. So we're screening the service window, but then we're also stacking the queuing cars. And this is a good opportunity then to kind of go back and say, so why are we concerned with the service window? We did have the purpose statement, but specifically here, we've touched on it a little bit. But as you can see, I think from this, it's a better story to tell visually. Is that the face of the building we want facing the street? And that regulation is meant to say, no, we don't want this. We want something that has more windows. We want more entrances. We want a more active, visible business from the public street. And so that's really the genesis behind saying, no, let's put those service windows on the back, because when you put a service window on a building, that's usually where your kitchen's going to be, and kitchens usually don't have windows. And so it really is the working part of the building. So we'd like that pushed back, if possible, away from the street. And there's some more details on the landscaping. It's 3 feet. It's continuous, 80% opacity. So very standard with a lot of other our landscape screening requirements. So that's option one. So you do both of those, you can have a service window facing the street. The second option is it's less of an option and more of a recognized exception, right? If you have such severe grades that you can't see your service window from the street, then you don't need to screen it. You don't need to build a porte cochere. So that's the second way that you could have a service window facing a street. Number eight, that is the final section of general requirements. So again, all of these are applying to all drive-up facility uses. And this is, it's a little more detail and information about when a traffic impact analysis is required. And I'll have to apologize and point out an error I made. So it shouldn't be traffic impact analysis. It's actually transportation impact analysis. That is what it is described as in the code. I think I made a mental note at some point to change it, but that will be fixed before it goes to City Council. So this section requires a traffic impact analysis for drive-up facility uses. Transportation impact analysis is required for any new development that exceeds 100 new trips in the peak hour. So that's the current city standard. So this adds an additional layer for this specific use where we're just going to require it all the time. Because of the propensity generally for the impacts of drive-through facilities to be much higher than a lot of uses, and speaking with our traffic and engineers, in most situations, a drive-through facility is going to exceed 100 trips in that peak hour anyway. So this is going to capture all of them, even if maybe they came under that threshold just a little bit. It gives some information about the evaluation factors for the traffic impact analysis, such as looking at levels of service and street capacity and the effects on circulation, both internal and also external. Below that, so eight is the traffic impact analysis, and then it has three conditions, below that, where it will automatically be triggered. And so the last one of those is when it's accessory to a restaurant. The first one is basically if they're going to have a new curb entrance, so a new curb cut with an entrance to a public street, and that entrance is within 300 feet of an intersection. And speaking with our street engineering, our traffic engineering, that's a pretty standard measurement for that nearness to an intersection is where they really want to start paying attention to where that driveway is going to be and if there's going to have an impact on stacking, impacting traffic coming through that intersection. So if it's closer than 300 feet, it's going to have a traffic impact analysis. I'm going to call it a TIA. We'll just say TIA because I don't say transportation apparently. So, and that's an external intersection. Some of our conversation in the work session also were concerned with internal circulation in larger developments where it almost had its own internal street network. So we wanted to differentiate between those and still require it even if it is internal. An example I think we looked at and that I like to use is, I forget the name of the development, but Shops of Stadium. That has kind of an internal street network. You have Chick-fil-A there, you have McDonald's, and it has roads that are really acting almost as public streets. And so we wanted the ability to say we also want to look at how it's going to impact that internal traffic management. So if that condition's met, with basically a access within 300 feet of an internal or external intersection, and if the drive-up facility is accessory to a restaurant, those three conditions will automatically trigger a traffic impact study, a TIA. So in addition to the 100 trips, then those three conditions will require it for drive-up facilities. So that concludes all the new general requirements. So the third section within drive-up facility use-specific standards is conditional use. So we do have conditional uses actually in most of the, I shouldn't say most, so the MN district, mixed-use neighborhood, MOF, all drive-up facilities are conditional uses. So they have to come and receive conditional use approval. They come through this body, and then they go to City Council. While talking about that, we talked about maybe the need to have a little bit more language in there that explains what we want to be looking at when we're thinking about approving a conditional use for a specific site. We have some use-specific standards that do have that now. We have a set of a set of standards for general conditional uses, but some uses add additional standards to say conditional use standards, you need to make those as well. But for these specific uses, there's a few more things that we want to make sure are mitigated or that aren't concerns for your use. So in this case, for drive-up facilities, that's what we're doing with the conditional use. So this is basically kind of a statement that's saying, we're going to look at these following standards for conditional uses when it comes in. And the things that we're looking at really is to ensure that the drive-through lanes, stacking spaces, paved area, all that's necessary for this drive-up, and that it's not going to be detrimental to the surrounding neighborhoods, the character of the area, whether it is residential or commercial. And it also gives the commission the ability actually to increase standards or even decrease, depending on the context. Some MN zone properties may not be anywhere near residential properties. They may not have any issues with circulation, so there may be something that an applicant would like to request some additional relief from, and that gives them the ability to come and request it from the commission. So we have a set of seven use-specific standards. So we'll go through the first four real quick. Number one, so these are criteria and requirements for conditional use approval of a drive-up facility. So the drive-up facility can't be located on a facade that faces an abutting residential zoning district. So in certain situations, you wouldn't be able to face the street with your service window, but if everything behind you or to the side of you is zoned residential, you wouldn't be able to face your service window there. So in there's some situations that a service window would not be permitted, so a drive-up facility would not be permitted on that site. But the conditional use does allow the applicant to come back to come with a conditional use request and ask for relief from that requirement in case there are some circumstances that would warrant it. The second standard is nearest point of the drive-up facility basically must be 50 feet from an abutting residential district, so it gives us a little additional buffer when we're adjacent to residential areas. We're asking for good pedestrian markings for crosswalks and such with drive-up facilities, especially when they're on the street-facing sides. There isn't sometimes that attention to how pedestrians are supposed to enter the site and get into the building, so we're looking for a little bit more thoughtful approach when we're saying this is how a pedestrian will go from the public right-of-way into the building. There'll be marked crosswalks. There's some thought put into that. There's not really a requirement for that now, but in this case with conditional uses, the expectation is these lots would be not on big commercial corridors. They're a little more in closer to neighborhoods perhaps, and so it'd be appropriate to think of pedestrian infrastructure more than it had it been on an MC by the mall maybe. So number four is location, size, design, and characteristics of the building will be reasonably compatible and have minimal negative impact on nearby properties. So it needs to basically fit into the neighborhood. Internal circulation and access to and egress from the site will not substantially be impaired or will not impair the movement of other modes of transportation, bicycles, pedestrians to and through the site. So this is another kind of internal circulation issue, and it's something that would come from the conclusions of the traffic impact analysis. So if there's concerns that it could impact pedestrian movement, whether it's a high pedestrian traffic area, or it could compromise safety on the nearby roads, whether they are within a neighborhood area, that's something that would allow the commission to review the traffic impact study and point to this section of code, say, no, you aren't meeting this provision, so you need to do something to mitigate these concerns. Six is more of a requirement that anytime we do a drive-up facility conditional use, it needs to have a pretty well complete site plan so it can be evaluated. Another seven is another traffic impact analysis requirement, but now it reduces the trips generated to 50. So it cut in half the threshold for when it's required. And that's, again, to kind of put a higher threshold on these type of uses. So not just 100, but just 50 in some situations is enough for us when it's a conditional use to require a transportation impact analysis. So that is really the three sections that would be going in the use-specific standard. So again, purpose, general requirements, conditional use requirements. And the kind of second part of Amendment 1 really is jumping over to parking and loading. So there are a couple sections in there that seem to fit a little more with use-specific standards. Parking and loading is really a very technical section, right? Like how wide is your lane? How big is something? So we took 2 and 3 here, moved them to use-specific standards. They fit a little better there. But everything here was captured and just restated again in the sections we just saw. So with that, that is A1. That concludes my overview of that. And I'd be happy to stop on this one and go ahead and take questions, because this one's probably the most involved of all.
I think that would probably be best. Before we do start peppering you with questions, do any of my fellow commissioners have any ex parte related to this particular amendment they would like to share? Thank you very much. Commissioner McMahon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Planner Smith, use specific standards, number 6. Could we return to that slide, please?
There, that one?
Or conditional use, Mr. McMahon.
Conditional
the
use.
The general requirement 6, and there's in a conditional use 6.
Conditional use 6.
Conditional use, okay.
Where I'm going with this is we, in our work session, in our research, and we brought this up, and then we noticed it whilst we were discussing it. We had several situations whereby the staff coming from the building were kind of put in an awkward position, as that they had to cross the queuing line, the stacking lane. This number 6 says all entrance and egress. Would that cover that particular situation? Are you following me at all in my question?
This is 6 for conditional use standards, right? Or for conditional use standards?
All I think this location. Is where it says all ingress and egress. All existing and proposed points of ingress and egress. Would that cover the situation where we had a problematic area? There was one service provider that was brought up in the discussion, and we also noticed that Canes also has this, where staff actually will walk across the stacking lane, and the visibility is low, and we discussed, you know, mirrors and stuff of this nature. Would what I just mentioned be covered by number 6, all existing and proposed?
Which section are we in? I want to verify. Is it, where is it?
All existing.
All existing proposed points. Okay.
29-3.3JJ6VI.
Okay. So all existing and proposed points of ingress and egress. So that's the requirement that the site plan is going to show all points of ingress and egress. That's usually generally a little more traffic centric. So where are cars entering and exiting? But I do think
if my
pedestrian facilities, that would fall under that. So any pedestrian facilities, crosswalks, sidewalk entrances, that should be shown on the site plan as well.
I just want to make sure that we're covering the staff also, because we're pretty good about people entering the site. But at a Sonic or something like that, where we've got staff exiting, the one in the example in the work session, they're exiting like right there at the stacking lane. I just want to make sure that's addressed, because a lawsuit's the wrong time to address that.
Right, so that would be...
And where would that go, I guess, is my...
Yeah, more attention on basically a staff entrance that may not get the same
attention. Also attention upon those issues.
Right. I wouldn't say that's specifically covered in what we've got here.
I would tend to agree with Mr. Smith. I think what you have here really... The site plan is going to have to cover both internal and external facilities, and I'm looking at this particular provision and trying to figure out where we can expressly cover the issue of what you're suggesting, Mr. McMahon, and that's an internal pedestrian facilities. Not necessarily how it's
correct.
Being.
You wouldn't see me exiting the door by the service window to bring Commissioner Placer a sandwich.
And I think that's the way that this is probably, site plan generally being something that we're looking at the external components of it. Now, I think the provision above it in number 5, internal circulation and access to and egress from, I mean, again, the impetus behind a lot of this had to deal with vehicular, not necessarily pedestrian. It's a matter, I think, of us becoming accustomed to what is intended with addressing. And that
I'm
may
just
be
trying
a revision
to ensure that we do address that.
Yeah. That may
be the two situations that we have. They're problematic, and someone's going to get bumped at least.
The purpose statement. Does the purpose statement? Because I think the area that you we may see that we can address that could potentially be addressed in the general purpose statement, where we're dealing with both external and interior features to the site, and we could cover it in more of a generalized statement. So as an applicant's reading through these use specific standards, they understand that they cover the broader internal and external component.
I just want to make sure, and I understand that the administrative process and regulatory process will take some time to apply. Commissioner Kerr is telling me she thinks it's in five also. I just want to make sure we get it covered. That's all.
Yeah. So that section is the conditional use, so they will only apply when it's a conditional use. I would say three is maybe also kind of coming at it as well. Three is where we're saying you need to show some sort of pedestrian access from the public sidewalk into the building. There might be a way to kind of punch that up a little bit.
It might be a punch up might be good, because that says public and everything. And we're doing this. We're doing it for safety, and we're doing it to make it a livable and an inviting space.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure the staff is covered by that.
We get to look at that. And again, though, that's only going to apply in conditional use cases where it's situated right now.
Commissioner Lowe.
Mr. Smith, item 29.3.3JJ7A, the Port Cochere landscaping option, would that allow the Sonic scenario? And
most likely not.
Yes.
And
yeah,
I think we had talked about that, and I think
missed that work session. So if you can fill me in.
If I can recall, I think there was a recognition that was a bit of a one-off situation for that specific use, and that, you know, there still had the variance process in that situation to address it. It'd be hard to kind of, I think, take those circumstances and apply it to a standard that's going to apply to everywhere. So I think we kind of narrowed it down to just the Port Cochere allowance. But you're right, we did talk about the Sonic. But that was my recollection of where we left it.
Okay. As long as it's been discussed and addressed by this group. And then the communication that we received that was on the dais asking about the traffic generation study in lieu of the traffic impact analysis. Did you have any comment on that?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. I should have stated that at the beginnings. We did have one public comment from this, and we had sent this out to kind of a group of our local design professionals for comment, too, so we wanted to hear back from them. And we did receive one comment back from a gentleman. And one of those comments, he had two comments. One was to this section. And one, a concern was that a transportation impact analysis can sometimes require maybe more than is necessary for just maybe a simple drive-through, you know, review. So I did have the opportunity to talk to our traffic engineer, and he was very confident that the way they do it now is they have a scoping meeting ahead of time, and they will identify what he feels is necessary to be in that traffic study. So I think I understand his concern, but I think it's kind of addressed in our administration of that section now. So, and there's a second one, and I'll bring that up if someone reminds me when we get to the easement section. So thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Wilson? No? Okay. Any other questions for staff? Legal, I assume you want us to vote on each of these separately? Okay. I, without objection, am going to do the public hearing now, since I think we may have some comment on this. Okay. With that, is there anyone here from the public who has comment on this amendment? Please come forward, state your name and address for the record, and please get as close to the microphone as you feel comfortable so our listeners at home can hear you.
Good evening. Is that close enough?
That's good.
My name is Benjamin Ross. I live at 205 Pawpaw Way, Ward 2 of the City of Columbia. I'm a professional engineer. I'm a board-certified professional transportation operations engineer. I used to work at a fast food restaurant, And one of my biggest qualifications to talk to you tonight is I am an obese American who is an expert at identifying fast food restaurant drive-thrus and how they operate. So I think that's really important. My colleague, Matt Creedy, is the one who sent in the information to you, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But I found out about this issue or the proposed changes to the UDC on September 15th when Clint sent out the announcement. I was not aware of the work sessions that you all had, so I was not able to attend those or listen to your discussions. But I did review the meeting minutes. And as far as Amendment 1, I'll just read some comments that I have. I think the main goal, and I support this, is we're trying to screen and protect the quality of life in residential areas. We don't want a bunch of new drive-thrus or loudspeaker noises, you know, impacting people's homes. I think that's very good. But I think when we consider that option versus drive-thrus, like the Culver's has been used as an example a bunch of times, when you've got something that's right along a 9-lane wide highway, you know, what are you screening from? I mean, you made them build this wall, but there's a 9 lanes of traffic, and then the other side of that is another fast food restaurant, and then the mall, Columbia Mall parking lot. So I think that's a bad example, and actually, it's not a good use of resources. I know you talked about security during one of your meetings. That was on your June 23rd meeting. I think it's important for the police to be able to drive by and see what's going on at the window. You know, is there some crime happening? Hopefully not. But I just think the portico chair at the Culver's is a bad example in a place where it's not necessary. I think the term you talk about R1 and R2 zone property, and I think it should be residential use instead of R zoning. And the example I have there, the bank I go to is the Central Bank on West Broadway, and it's got an ATM machine that faces to the Broadway Christian Church, which is an R1 zone. But the Broadway Christian Church is not residential. They have a big yard, a big parking lot, and the church. It's quite a distance away. So I think the use is the important thing, not the zoning. That's one of my comments. You have the several different criteria that would allow a service window to face the street. The portico chair, the 3 foot lower and not being able to be seen. I think the total distance from the public street should be added in. That was talked about, but I think that if your distance is so far away that, you know, you're not even gonna see it from the road, I think that should be allowed too. It doesn't matter if it's facing the street, but if it's so far away, it should be fine. The traffic study. And then I was very surprised that in your July 7th minutes, it seemed like the Planning and Zoning Commission did not want to allow staff to review on a case-by-case basis. And we've got a lot of smart engineers working for the city, and you talked about the Sonic as a one-off. We need to let the staff have the authority to use their judgment, their professional judgment, to decide what is, you know, how will they protect the quality of life and at the same time help developers and entrepreneurs develop as, you know, efficiently as possible. You know, we're all trying to protect the quality of life in Columbia. But we also want common sense to prevail as quickly and as inexpensively as possible. You talked about the difference between a transportation impact analysis and a traffic study. This is the book on how to do transportation impact analysis. It's 123 pages long. Here's a flow chart that you have to run through to do this. It is pretty expensive. The Culver's, back to that example, they hired Lockmuller Group out of St. Louis, and they did a 15-page study. And right on the first page it says, it is important to note that the following assessment does not represent a traffic impact study. So a study is maybe a little bit less than the transportation impact analysis. So I think it's important that the scoping that we talked about does take place. So we're doing the proper level of engineering work to meet the needs of the community. We don't need to go overkill. I don't want to have a one-size-fits-all checklist requirement that you have to follow what's in this book. Okay, we don't want that. We want engineering judgment to be used. In the meeting minutes, you also talked about allowing alternative data. I've been involved in some projects where it's maybe it's not a nationwide franchise, but it's like they have several stores and they've got their own data that they developed over decades. I think if an entrepreneur comes in and they can point to there are 10 stores in St. Louis and they all need this much parking or this much stacking distance, we need to listen to that. You know, not everything is going to be in the IT ebook. We need to listen to the entrepreneurs who have, you know, real world experience. I definitely support the staff's desire for flexibility. That was again in the July 21st work session minutes. Like the 300 foot, that seems like a pretty arbitrary number to me. And how is that even measured? Is it 300 feet from the service window in the radius out to the next intersection? Is it 300 feet from the parcel of the ground? And then, or is it the stacking distance allowed? And then I'll go to Chick-fil-A, one of my favorite restaurants. It's on Stadium Boulevard. They have 300 feet of stacking distance, 327 feet of stacking distance from their normal menu board and microphone in the speaker box on their own site before they even get to the internal circulation road that you talked about. That 327 feet was not nearly enough during the pandemic. Traffic, they had two lanes of traffic, and it backed all the way out of their property onto the circulation road on the shopping center and out onto Stadium Boulevard and block traffic on Stadium Boulevard. That was pandemic conditions when the dining room was closed, other restaurants were closed, and there's pretty few restaurants available then. But that should not be the criteria that we look at. You can't judge the pandemic conditions on the problem at that site. So the 300 feet, I think, needs to be looked at very carefully. There's a huge difference between an ATM out at the very edge of a parking lot, which would have very few cars an hour, but might be within 300 feet of the service road or the public street intersection, versus a drive-through, a big fast food drive-through.
If you could wrap up your comments, we'd appreciate that. Thank you.
There's also a difference between drive-through and curbside pickup, another phenomenon from the pandemic. Curbside pickup does not have menu boards or speakers. It should be treated differently. The drive-through stacking distance impacts site parking. You need to have enough parking on site, and I hope the P&Z board will review the rules regarding additional parking beyond what's allowed by the UDC, because the board of adjustment process to allow more parking in this community is completely broken. I can talk to you a lot more about that later. But just to wrap up, I want to say that thank you for the opportunity. We need to have we need to allow the city staff, engineers, to use judgment on a case-by-case basis. I know no one-size-fits-all, but common sense prevail. And there's a big difference between an ATM out the edge of a parking lot and a big fast food restaurant next to a neighborhood. So thank you for listening.
Thank you. If you would just wait for a minute. Does anyone have any questions for the speaker?
I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. Anyone else to have public comment on this amendment? Again, name, address, and since I forgot to mention it, we do usually limit people to 3 minutes if you're an individual and 6 minutes.
Not a problem. I'll try to adhere to that.
Thank you.
Tom Trebue, 3530 South Old Ridge Road, Columbia. I'm going to go through it almost line by line, not all the lines, I promise that. But I do want to echo what Ben said, is a lot of times when we think about drive-up facilities, we think about restaurant drive-throughs, and we have a lot of other drive-up facilities that don't have near the impact as a restaurant drive-through. In Section 2 in the general requirements, it talks about the property edge buffering being the level 3 property edge buffering. I know that that's not a change. That's just been restated differently than it was before. But I want to say I complained about this when we were doing the UDC amendments before. I think that level of landscaping and buffering, 10-foot landscape buffers, and 8-foot tall screening next to an R1 zoning is overkill. Item number 2, no speakers shall face an R1 or R2 zoning district. I would recommend that be stricken, because that's covered by item 4, where it talks about noise control ordinances. I'm really not a big fan of these absolutes. The technology's changing. We're seeing a lot of changes in the way we handle drive-through facilities with all of these, all the different drive-through facilities and restaurants. Item number three, no menu boards shall be visible from an R1 or R2. I'm not even sure exactly what that means, because it depends on screening, it depends on, you know, I mean, I can make it not visible pretty easily. I can do different types of lighting, so I think that's something that probably should be addressed. I want to echo what Ben talked about on the portico shares. The ordinance says screen from the ground to the roof. And what they did at Culver's is really a travesty. I expect when I drive up or drive by a drive-through restaurant to see a service window. I expect to see stacking cars. I don't expect to see an architectural storefront. I think those are reasonable expectations. And so I don't know that we need to spend a lot of money and dictate those types of architectural things for our drive-up windows. The landscaping section directly below the portico share, the last sentence, the landscaping installed in this landscape area shall be in addition to other landscaping requirements. I would request that that be stricken. I think that just adds a requirement here that is going to get lost in the shuffle, because we already have landscaping requirements as percentages that are tied to the site already. So I would like to see that stricken. Item number three under the conditional use. Item number one, where it says drive-up facility service shall not be located on a building facade that faces a residential zoning district. I understand this is a conditional use and that they can ask for relief. But if we're going to allow them to ask for relief, why do we have this absolute in here that you can't do it? I mean, that's the first thing I'm going to read as a developer, as a new business coming into our community. I'm going to read that and say, you're not going to let me put that on the against the residential zoning district. But if I know the rules here, well, maybe I can. So let's get rid of these absolutes if we can. And I would argue that a service window is probably way less intrusive than menu boards or speakers. And so again, that's a reason to eliminate that absolute. And then item number four, with regarding the architectural characteristics of the drive-through, the building and the drive-through. And we went through this when we did the downtown architectural standards. I'm very much opposed to the city and a planning and zoning commission imposing architectural design standards to a building owner or developer. They're going to make sure that it blends in appropriately. I believe that strongly. It will be in their taste, and that's okay. It may not agree with my taste, it may not agree with your taste, but I don't think as a city planning and zoning commission that we should be dictating architectural standards. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for this speaker? No? Thank you very much. Anyone else to speak on this amendment? Seeing none. Do we have any commissioner discussion about the amendment? Commissioner Stanton.
Like some of the ideas that I heard, do we modify now or we just take note of what we heard?
You can't be heard. Sorry.
I like some of the things I heard this evening. Do we modify the amendments and vote, or do we just take note of what the public input is and address it at a later time?
I think we can make revisions to the code that's in front of you now.
We already know we have one per staff's recommendation to change the term to transportation.
Yes.
Impact analysis.
Yes, so there'll be some minor, and I should say that City Attorney had pointed out a couple minor things, too, that need to be corrected. So there will be some minor revisions. So if we need to make some substantive revisions, we can do that as well. We'll try to do it in this venue, but if it gets really complicated, then we may need to come back.
Commissioner McMahon? I'm sorry. Commissioner Stanton, was that? Okay. Commissioner McMahon.
The technical corrections, absolutely. I respect these gentlemen very much, and I appreciate what Commissioner Stanton is saying. For those of us who were here during the UDC, and for those of us who've been through the work sessions on this, for every objection that was just raised, we have received significant testimony going the other way around, and we do have compromised documents. This is not Santa Fe. It's not downtown Ann Arbor, where it's all dictated. Relief is possible. And we had to, and I think these guys know this, we have a broad spectrum of drive-thrus. And to try to capture all of them without having dozens more clauses and amendments would be very difficult. It is broad-based. The premise of all of these restrictions uses flows from this is a conditional use. If one has a large objection, maybe that would be the, because in some communities they're not conditional uses. You can just have one. But we do have everything from the drive-through to a Chick-fil-A or a McDonald's or something like that. And we do have, and we remember in work session, if I will help your all's memory, we have a lot of retrofitted conditional use or drive-throughs, which are really problematic. And we're trying to address those issues. And a lot of it's very site-specific, and a lot of it is up to staff and to communicate that. Changing some of the stacking regulations and the distances to mitigate some of this is beneficial. I think it is. It may be a little overly detailed, but I think it's far less than I can hear many of the, I remember during the UDC, people wanting to go much, much further than what we did as far as form standards and things of that nature. We've restated some things, and I think added clarity, and I appreciate staff's attention to detail and the quality of the work sessions we had on this, because I thought we had some quality work sessions. And it is a compromise as it stands. So I would be opposed to any significant changes in the other direction, because I think this is a median document the way it is. Thank you.
Commissioner Carroll.
The comment that I'd like to make, and Planner Smith, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe that the intent for the addition of the porte cochere and landscaping, grade changes, et cetera, on the non-street facing facade was to allow additional options so that you could have a drive-through on a non-street facing facade. Those options were not previously available. So it's not that we're trying to regulate you more. We're trying to give you more options so that you could have something that previously you weren't allowed to have. I think that intent when we're looking at this is important. We're not trying to impose on you. I do have quite a bit of faith in our city engineers and our engineering professionals.
If I could follow up on that. I think
I'm going to go to Commissioner Wilson first, and then we'll hear from staff. Fine. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Go ahead. I apologize. I know you had a follow-up. So I will say I feel like, because I'm new, I'm going to throw that card in. I appreciate the conversation, but if we're going to literally start making changes, I'd actually rather have the opportunity to think it through and have more discussion. It just takes me more time to process and understand what we're talking about, why are we saying it, what are the possible consequences and impacts. All of that needs a little bit further discussion than I think we could have here this evening. So that's just my only ask, is that if we are going to make some changes, that we don't do that right now.
Planner Zinner.
So to draw off of what Ms. Carroll had pointed out, the option that existed prior to these revisions being prepared was a Board of Adjustment action. And I think many that have gone before the Board of Adjustment understand the limitations that that board has in being able to grant relief. So this is a clarification of the intent of the code with an opportunity to allow for alternatives versus sending a project for a further delay to a Board of Adjustment that has very limited ability to be able to modify or manipulate the requirements. So that is also part of what is the impetus behind this. It was to add the clarity. We have been very fortunate that the projects that came before us, to which the options were actually authorized, were plan zones. So we have not encountered at this point a project developed in an open zoning classification that would allow a drive-through in an MC zoning district on an MC property. We have not had one built yet since this code has been adopted, and I guarantee you we would have been being requested to make changes when that project was potentially denied the ability to be able to establish a drive-through in a location that would have otherwise been permissible, either by this body or potentially by our Board of Adjustment, because the criteria for granting relief to a zoning provision could not have been proven. And that is, again, that these regulations clarify options available. If those options are not significant enough to give the commission in a condition of where a drive-through is a principally permitted use, which would be really under the general conditions, that may be somewhere where we have to then table discussion on this amendment, go back and take into account the commentary that has been made here this evening to avoid you being in a position of reviewing a development plan to where our response has to be the board is the one that has to decide that.
Commissioner McMahon.
I would like to do a little procedural thing to clarify and move this forward if that's possible. Respecting.
Are there any other, Commissioner Stanton?
Yeah, this went a little deeper than I thought, but I just had like a word change. I didn't want to change like amendments. I just want a little word change based on the residential R1 versus residential intent.
Use.
I kind of like that. That's all I wanted. I wasn't trying to like rewrite the Constitution, but I do understand what Commissioner McMahon is saying. If we have worked on this pretty hard, if we just want to up and down vote it, I'm cool with that. I just wanted a little word change is all I was thinking.
I would how about this? Lay it on me, Anthony. What you got?
If I'm correct, instead of saying R1, saying residential use or in... I forgot what this... I didn't write it down what the speaker said, but I liked it.
I am...
I have a response to that.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Trebu is absolutely correct. However, flip it around. Are you with me, Commissioner Lowe? If you flip that around and apply it, it's just as problematic the other way, or more problematic. Because of where we have businesses, we have old code, new code buildings. You flip it around. Right now we have a come to the hazard situation. We turn that on its head.
Okay.
So I think it's...
I concede. I'm done.
All right.
I'm laying down.
Commissioner Lowe.
And... while we've had people come before us in public comment and say that a church is ostensibly a commercial use, schools are also allowed in R1, and frankly, I would want to protect schools from this as well. So I think I understood the comment, but I'm not sure all R1 uses would necessarily. Yeah, okay.
Any further discussion? Staff, are you satisfied with our discussion?
We're more than satisfied. I mean, if you're willing to move the ordinance as it is, or if you want additional discussion on it in a work session, we can stay action on this, take under consideration whatever you'd like.
I don't think that's necessary. Commissioner McMahon?
I'd like to call the question.
Commissioner Wilson, you had further comment?
Yes, I do, because if it's problematic for me, and I'm sure you're about to ask us to do the up or down. Previously, I don't think I understood what a traffic impact study actually was, and so seeing that information this evening, now that makes me rethink what the actual requirement should be. So it would be problematic for me to have to vote this up or down. Obviously, I will if that's what we decide to do. But there are just some things that were mentioned tonight that I feel like need further discussion.
Commissioner Carroll.
Could we get some clarification from staff on that, actually? For example, in the initial scoping meeting with traffic engineering, I suppose, would they be able to determine what elements of that study needed to be performed?
Yes, the purpose for a scoping study is to determine what intersections, what criteria the design professional, the traffic engineer, is going to need to be evaluating. That scoping study is not done in the absence of the applicant. So, I mean, they're going to be there and discussing the nature of what the expectation is of the outcome of the numbers. And I think, as both our speakers indicated, we have a highly competent engineering staff. We don't proceed forward in requesting a TIA without understanding the implications associated with that. There is an obligation, however, and I think both of our speakers also acknowledge this, that we're in a position that we need to protect the public. And therefore, you have to allow discretion to the professional staff that is trained to assess what those issues are, because they work within that environment on a daily basis. And therefore, the way that the regulation is written, it is inherently written broadly in not by specifying what is contained specifically in that traffic analysis, that transportation analysis, because they have to have that discretion. With every major development that comes before you, the choice of the projections for going backward, going forward, the intersections that we analyze, all of that is site-specific, development-specific, and that is determined every time we do a traffic study that's triggered. And we would not see this process being any different.
For myself, I'm fine with a straight up-down vote as long as we have, which I believe we do, confidence that they would not require a full TIA in every circumstance, and it doesn't sound like that is the case.
If I may, just to point out a couple things I think might kind of relieve some of those concerns. I think, and I'm not a traffic engineer, but from my understanding, basically your standard drive-through restaurant is almost always going to trigger that on our standard requirement, the 100 trips. A lot of new development, too, they'll do a traffic impact analysis for an entire commercial development, not just one lot, so it's kind of rolled into one. So I think the instances where we're going to get maybe like one small infill lot that is required to do it, maybe in excess of maybe what's needed, it's going to be a very small percentage of cases, I think. And it may not be any for that matter. So I think that window of where we would want to say this type of use in this specific location and circumstances and size of building may not need it, I think it's very small. So I can't guarantee that, but I think that is the case.
And I'll just add, I'm looking at the language. It includes the purpose of the traffic impact analysis and doesn't say it has to be a full analysis. So I think that it gives leeway as well. Anyone else? Commissioner Placer.
Yes, I can't believe I'm saying this, but just a point in favor of the porte cochere. We have a general principle that the front of buildings faces the street, and this was a compromise to make it look like a building front facing. I know it's an ugly street. I know it's 9 lanes wide, but it was supposed to look like the front rather than having the side of a restaurant facing the street. So, and we have to remember we heard a lot of bad examples of previous construction that violated all this stuff and has created some ugly situations in parts of Columbia. Maybe I'm being snobby there, but the issue is going forward, what can we do without becoming Santa Fe or Scottsdale or someplace like that? We can make this place look decent.
That, I think we're ready for you.
I was saying I'm good.
We're ready for you, Commissioner McMahon.
I have, I want to get something on the record to hopefully in the future allay some of our professional colleagues' concerns. Situations was maybe problematic, as these gentlemen said. Someone coming in from out of town. Usually somebody coming in from out of town, they're pretty well healed. You can have a local contact, so we'll hire a local agent. Regardless, I would encourage you gentlemen, and this is on from the record, to direct them to their full options. The other situation I thought of as they were speaking, and this is worthwhile, the gentleman who developed the drive-through coffee across from Hickman might not have all the means to hire professional staff up and down the line if we can help them too. That said, Ms. Thompson, I'm going to make an amendment case, an amendment A1, an A1 only, in the positive, and then go from there. Is that what you wanted?
Yes.
Thank you, ma'am. In the matter of case 262-2022, amendment A1 with technical corrections, I move to approve.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner McMahon, seconded by Commissioner Stanton. Any further discussion? Seeing none, may we please have a roll call?
Commissioner Lowe?
Yes.
Commissioner Stanton?
Yes.
Commissioner McMahon?
Aye.
My vote is yes. Commissioner Galway Jones?
Yes.
Commissioner Placer?
Yes.
Commissioner Kimball?
Yes.
Commissioner Wilson?
Yes.
We have 8 votes to approve. The motion carries.
With that, let's do the rest in 30 minutes.
3 or 30?
30.
Okay.
Planner Smith, would you like to move on to Amendment 2?
Yes, I would. So this is a provision. It's located in our subdivision section. So that's Section 5.1 subdivision standards. So actually, it is the very last paragraph of 5.1. In that it is a requirement that easements be provided abutting a public street in all situations for platting. And that's generally fine. But with the introduction of the MDT has a standard where all buildings, for the most part, should be built to the required building line, which is essentially at the street. So we have a conflict. Reviewing this with our utilities department, they recognize that downtown, most of the utilities are really in the right-of-way. There are utilities under the existing buildings now downtown because the existing kind of architectural fabric of downtown is buildings built to the front lot line. So they were okay with adding language that accepted out property zoned MDT from a mandatory requirement to dedicate a 10-foot utility easement abutting a street when they plat. We kept in a provision, though, that would allow them to require it upon review of a site if they determined that there's not sufficient space in the right-of-way to adequately serve utilities. And that language is actually taken from our utilities section. So we wanted to be consistent with what's the standard for what they're looking for. And that, I'll just read it real quick, is that they can require that easement if there's insufficient area within existing street or alley rights of way to allow for the adequate provision of current and future city services and facilities. So with that provision, they are recommending approval of this as well. They're in favor of it. So it would remove that mandatory requirement that all plats downtown have that 10-foot utility easement. So I'd be happy to answer your questions on this one.
Before we get there, you wanted us to remind you about the comment.
Yes. So we did receive another comment, and we did look at this, and we think this is maybe not ready for right now. We'll kind of keep it in mind. It's addressing an issue that exists now, If a lot had a platted easement, would it be a non-conforming building if it was not built to the required building line? So that exists now, so nothing we're doing is changing that situation, and we haven't had that situation yet. So we're going to keep this kind of on that list, and if this becomes an issue, we might revisit it.
Very good. Thank you. Any commissioner questions? Go ahead, Commissioner McMahon.
I just have a quick question. The second part where it can be reviewed and required if needed, this addresses, there's a handful of commercial structures that I'm aware of existing, mm-hmm. and several residential, like houses on lots. They're definitely not at the RPL, and they probably do have city utilities in their yards, and that would allow the utility department to make that assessment on a case-by-case basis. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Yeah. This also will rectify the problem we had on, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, South 6th, South 5th, where we were going to try to shoehorn the utilities underneath the building and all that. You remember that? It was one of the first objections we had to, I can't put the utilities here. I've got to put the RVL. This addresses this issue. Generally?
Generally, it would. I mean, again, in an instance where the utilities director is requiring that the utility easement be provided, it is going to probably create a situation as to which is more important, maintaining the RBL and the integrity of the downtown, or ensuring that the utilities have sufficient location to be placed within. The majority of our utilities, I think, as we have identified, are in our rights of way to begin with. But that's, and so it's difficult. I think if you think of the property I'm thinking of is the sub shop on 9th or 8th.
South 8th is where it
South is. South 8th. And of course, their building is nowhere near the required building line, and it is very possible that there may be utilities on their property.
I can tell you that there are utilities.
So if that building is brought forward, demolished and brought forward, the requirement would be basically, you have to build to the RBL. This particular provision would, in essence, and I think the point to the correspondence has been received, you would, in essence, be stating that that parcel's redevelopment is non-conforming to the MDT standard for RBL construction. In essence, the philosophy that is often utilized in our offices where you have an easement that exceeds the required setback, the easement line becomes your setback by default because you can't build within the easement. And at that juncture, you have to accept the reality that if the easement is essential, the RBL is behind the easement at that point. And it is not considered a nonconformity in the general sense of a nonconformity. It is, the building has been built to the RBL by the application.
Because we moved the RBL.
Yes, the RBL is required.
Do you think we'll make Mr. Crotty happy here?
I think the situation plays itself out in application already.
Mm-hmm.
We don't plat property and create nonconformities generally. We really,
I kind of understand his concern. I thought he might have had a specific property in mind. Last question, would this make Mr. Farnan happy? This was an issue of his over and over.
I mean, building to the RBL in general, because we want the building faces to share a common front, I imagine it would probably make Mr. Farnan happy that we would allow this relief. I don't know necessarily, though, how impactful it is to the architectural and frontage character, because you're still going to have to design that building meeting the other criteria within the MDT. It's just set slightly further back. Now, the question at that point then is if this problem should arise, how would we want to handle any type of landscape treatment in that particular area to try to mitigate that, or would we allow, for example, an outdoor cafe to occupy that portion of maybe added sidewalk? There are a whole series of other design-related issues that we would have to look at specific to that situation.
Do those issues now, we're looking at a redevelopment of existing properties for this to happen. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, to occupy so much of his time. I think these are valid questions.
You're eating into the 30 minutes.
I'm sorry. I just want to, this is an homage to Mr. Farnan. Currently, if that situation were to occur tomorrow, would those situations fall under director's discretion?
I don't think so. You're saying if they have an easement?
Somebody tore one down and we found a water line that's actually under the building.
So it's a little bit different situation, right? So an easement follows the utility, right? So the easement just protects it on top of it. But even if there's not an easement, I don't think, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I'm quite certain that a permit would not be issued to build over, say, a city water main. We would generally request that they provide us a water main easement at that time so that we do have the ability to maintain it. They would have a decision at that point whether they want to relocate the water main to a location
that is
allow
an option.
Redevelopment, and that certainly can happen.
Okay. I'm just going through this because we've had so many unique situations appear downtown, and we have had a developer, I think the Rises developer, move that water line, didn't he? Move something. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. This has been a long time, 5 years in coming, and I just want to make sure that we get it right. Thank you. Thank you for your tolerance, Madam Chair.
Anytime, Commissioner. Anyone else questions for the staff? Seeing none. Any public comment on Amendment 2? Seeing none. Any commissioner comment? Commissioner McMahon?
If my fellow commissioners have no other questions or concern on Amendment A2, I have a motion. In the matter of case 262-2022, Amendment A2, I move to approve.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner McMahon, seconded by Commissioner Stanton. Secretary Carroll, could we have a roll call?
Commissioner Lowe?
Yes.
Commissioner Stanton?
Yes.
Commissioner McMahon?
Aye.
My vote is yes. Commissioner Galway Jones?
Yes.
Commissioner Placer?
Yes.
Commissioner Kimball?
Yes.
Commissioner Wilson?
Yes.
We have 8 votes to approve. The motion carries.
Thank you. Lanner Smith, Amendment 3, when you're ready.
Amendment 3, we're changing Roman numeral 2 to the number 2. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any commissioner, any questions for the staff? No.
Next question.
Any public comment on Amendment 3? Seeing none. Any commissioner comment? Commissioner McMahon.
If my fellow commissioners do not have any more comments or concerns, I have a motion. In the matter of case 262-2022, Amendment A3, I move to approve.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner McMahon, seconded by Commissioner Stanton. Secretary Carroll, may we have a roll call?
Commissioner Lowe.
Yes.
Commissioner Stanton?
Yes.
Commissioner McMahon?
Aye.
My vote is yes. Commissioner Galway Jones?
Yes.
Commissioner Placer?
Yes.
Commissioner Kimball?
Yes.
Commissioner Wilson?
Yes.
We have 8 votes. The motion carries.
Thank you very much, Planner Smith.
Amendment 4, so the last one. So this is kind of a twofer, so you get a bonus. The big one here is we're removing almost all the references to C2. I'm not going to go through each section, just suffice it to say it's a bit of a cleanup maneuver. The C2, if you want a little history, was the leftover. It was synonymous with our MDT. It was our downtown zoning. Some areas outside of downtown were zoned that. When we did the adoption of the UDC, they weren't automatically transferred into a new district. We had to do them piece by piece. So we have no C2 now. That is where we're at. So we can eliminate all references to the C2, except the one I want to point out is here, where we mention in the table that we rezoned C2 to MDT. Everything else is going to be deleted. The very first one here, I'll note, that's the bonus, section 29-2.1 at the very beginning of that paragraph, that's unnecessary. So we're going to delete it. So it's not really related to C2, but we went ahead and did that while we were in here. So, and that's all I have. So we can go through each section on C2 if anyone would like to, but otherwise I'll rest my report and answer any questions.
I don't think that's necessary. Any questions for staff? Seeing none, any public comment? Seeing none, any commissioner comment? Commissioner McMahon.
I have a question. Ms. Thompson, when I'm done with this, would it be appropriate for us to make a motion to approve the entire thing? Or
I don't think that's necessary.
All right, well, we had done some of that with UDC. That's why I asked that question. Thank you, Ms. Thompson. If I may, and my fellow commissioners have no other comments or concerns, I'm going to make a motion. In the matter of case 262-2022, Amendment A4, I move to approve.
Second.
Moved by Commissioner McMahon, seconded by Commissioner Stanton. Secretary Carroll, may we have a roll call?
Commissioner Lowe.
Yes.
Commissioner Stanton.
Yes.
Commissioner McMahon.
Aye.
My vote is yes. Commissioner Galway Jones?
Yes.
Commissioner Placer?
Yes.
Commissioner Kimball?
Yes.
Commissioner Wilson?
Yes.
We have 8 votes to approve. The motion carries.
Thank you very much. And with that, the recommendation on all 4 amendments will be forwarded to City Council along with a staff report. And then we move on to further public comment. Is anyone here with public comment? No. Staff comments?
Our next meeting will be October 6th, and we do have a number of items on that public hearing agenda, as well as we will have a work session at 5:30 over in conference rooms 1A, 1B. We will continue our progressive conversation with short-term rentals. I appreciate your engagement today and our progress we made. So, what are your upcoming cases for October 6th? They are these, and there are 5 of them. We have a twofer in here, public hearing and a subdivision. That is for our Bristol Ridge project down on the south end of town off of Gans. It's a permanent zoning request, so it's an annexation, will be an annexation. County A1 to City R1, and then the corresponding preliminary plat. Prior to, however, getting to that, we will take care of another subdivision action up off of Paris Road. This is the project that is immediately to the north of the US 63 Paris Road interchange. We have previously seen this. It is only the subdivision. It is not a request for zoning, so that means the property will retain its existing zoning designations, but will be platted into a legally conforming lot. And then the 2 public hearings we have are both rezonings. One is a rezoning request out of PD to RMF, and that is an odd general request that you probably don't see frequently, where we go from a restricted district to an open and very possibly intense open zoning district. The PD on this particular property, however, is actually more intense than what the RMF zoning would permit, and this is a parcel that has now been submitted with in a consolidation plat to go into the Columbia Independent School property for future usage with the school. So Mr. Kelly will explain the details with that at your next meeting. And then the property, our last rezoning property, is at 2201 West Nifong. This is Woodcrest Chapel, directly across the street from Mill Creek Elementary. This is a rezoning to a planned zoning district with a development plan. And the purpose behind this is to allow for some adaptive reuse of existing facilities that are on the Woodcrest campus, given the changes in the usage of the Woodcrest facility. So the PD is providing some opportunities to allow for uses that are more commercial in nature, commercial and office in nature, and Mr. Smith will be going over that at our meeting in October and the details associated with that. So we're moving it out of an ag zoning district, and our ag district is an extremely, as many of you know, restrictive zoning district. It doesn't even allow, really, for the purposes of subdivision for residential development, but it does allow churches. And that is hence why the churches never had a problem until now. So you know where we're talking about, our Paris Road project, our 2 down there on the south end, just east, west of the Bristol Lake Drive, the extension of it, and Phillips Lake, and our park facilities. That is on the north side, of course, of Gans Road. And then our 2 other properties, the Timber Creek Drive CIS is the building there up along Route E, State Route E, Stadium Boulevard North, and then our Woodcrest Chapel facility there on the last slide. Those are all the projects that we have coming forward to you. We do have a pretty significant agenda also for the October 20th meeting. We'll have a similar amount of caseload, so expect to finish out the year probably at a pretty good clip with our projects. We did hold elections this evening, and I will let our currently seated chair, Ms. Gawe-Jones, elaborate on that. But I welcome aboard all of our new members that have maybe changed a little bit of their seating arrangement, as well as allowing an opportunity for us to change it up. So with that, that's all we have to offer this evening. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Yes, I would like to thank our former chairperson, Commissioner Lowe, for the many years of service and continuing to serve as vice chair for the next year. Very much appreciated. And thank you all to my fellow commissioners for trusting me to serve as chair for at least a year. We'll see how it goes. Commissioner Carroll, thank you for continuing to serve as our secretary. You do a lovely job, and we appreciate you. Any further comments from commissioners? In that case, I would entertain a motion. Commissioner McMahon?
I'd like to thank all of you anyway.
Oh, go ahead.
Particularly Ms. Lowe, because I know it's not an easy thing to do. I move to adjourn.
I would just like to say it was a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you all.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned.